It is a muggy, rainy day in Washington, D.C. on the corner of M and 18th Street and going to see Chris Graves. He's a behavioral scientist slash communications guy. And in Washington, D.C., in these days of truths, half-truths, and entirely false truths, we're going to try to get a handle on what he means by behavioral science in the age of Trump. This is Steve Stein, and yes, I made it out of the rain and into the office of Chris Graves, president and founder of the Ogilvy Center for Behavioral Science. Formerly, Chris served as global chairman and CEO for Ogilvy Public Relations, where he landed after spending more than two decades operating internationally with Dow Jones and its affiliates. As you'll hear, Chris is blessed with the gift of gab. He's one of the most thoughtful and articulate commentators on the art of communication, and in recent years, he's turned to science to better understand the underpinnings of the human condition. I went to Washington, where he's based, with a specific set of questions in mind. Like many of you, I've been perplexed over the last several months by the American response to the Trump administration's casual relationship with the truth. I could give you examples, but I'm not going to. There's no need. From my perch in Asia, I've been amazed by the American public's willingness to accept half-truths and flat-out lies. I started off by asking Chris why he thought this was happening. Has this been engineered, and how? What's the science behind America's newfound tolerance for falsehood?
When you look at it, what's happening, there's a kind of polarization, not just in the U.S., but in some other cultures, perhaps the U.K., that has been studied out of Yale University called the Cultural Cognition Project.
Explain that.
So picture a two-by-two grid, just like any good consultant would have. And on the vertical axis, at the top is hierarchical, and at the bottom is egalitarian. So they're polar extremes. So somebody who feels the world works better whenever you have a very strong boss or leader in charge and a very clear hierarchy, that person is very different to their polar opposite at the bottom of that vertical axis, who just believes in total egalitarian structure. You're not the boss of me. Never will be, never have been. Now, on the x-axis, horizontally, at the far left is individualist, and their extremes on the far right, not politically, but on the axis, are communitarians. So an individualist believes, you know what, human beings basically are most effective when you take care of yourself and your own, take accountability and responsibility, don't ask for handouts, don't look to the government for anything, it's just a big fat waste. Those who are more communitarian look at the plight of refugees or immigrants or income gap or gender gap or opportunity gap and say, you're human. Mm. We're all human. It's one family of humans. We have to solve this. Mm. The thing is that people don't change easily on this grid. And once you find yourself in this grid, it correlates to other views and behaviors. So for example, that hierarchical individualist really believes in the power of free markets and low regulation. They really believe in the authority of the nuclear family as a structure. They don't believe in rapid social change. It makes them very, very uncomfortable.
Chris, if this is an aspect of human beings cross-cultural and for all time, why does it feel so much more animated now and polarizing? Because if it's just a matter of being plotted on that chart, I get that. But why, and give us an example, let's say, you know, the Trump base, just to try to, you know, explain how this applies in this day and age.
Well, what has exacerbated, of course, as everybody might guess, is social media. Because once you find a tribe and that tribe reinforces all that identity, you not only suspect you're right, you know you are right.
So you're feeding it. You're feeding those biases.
Yes. And this is where, back to the confirmation bias, first of all, when somebody goes to Google something and if they see something that comes up to completely undermine what they currently believe, they're going to just skip past that. They're probably not going to delve into it and go, wow, that's unsettling. After 3 years of believing this, it's possibly not true. We just don't act that way.
Back to your science example. Yep. Science 17 years in the 18th theory to get some evidence. Same thing. I simply can't absorb that.
I'm too vested in this identity. I've gone too far out this branch. Humans just don't change that way. Okay. No matter how much we fool ourselves to think we're open-minded, ultimately it's something called identity cognition threat that out of Yale, that same group. And they basically, here's what's happening from an evolutionary point of view. We're using a software system, the brain, but our software system is a much slower upgrade process than our environment. So you think about what the world was like 40 years ago when we used punch cards for computers, for example. And you think about whether those punch cards might run your MacBook Pro or your Android or iOS system today, it would be ridiculous. But your brain, because it's an evolutionary change, is probably about 40,000 years old, not 40 years old. And that's all of us. So it's very buggy. When you put that 40,000-year-old brain in an environment of AR, VR, social media, digital, we are not wired for this. We're trying to cope as a species, but we're not wired for this. And so we make lots of what Dan Ariely, the behavioral scientist, calls predictably irrational behavior.
Yeah, and it's a form of manipulation. It's, and science can prove that, correct?
Well, it's not a manipulation in that we don't even know it's happening.
Yeah, there it is. So you're not aware of the manipulation, but in fact, they're almost hitting those hot buttons that you're predisposed towards.
Yes. And so, for example, if you look at kinds of things, you know, that on one political end of a spectrum or another might really agitate them. As I was saying before, the use of the term or the notion of disgust, you know, it's been shown in brain scans, in fact, that people who self-disclose on the right, they have a lower threshold for that. But that doesn't mean that people on the left are somehow higher ground moralistically or what have you. They have their other hot buttons that are sort of programmed in that way.
So the those that own the data, who have the insights, who are able to kind of understand behavioral science, can now deploy tactics in order to manage a populace, wherever they may be, to act or react accordingly. It sounds like science fiction.
So this is the thing on two fronts that are such big news. One is the sort of Russian Twitter bots and their role in meddling in a U.S. election. And the other is the Cambridge Analytica Facebook scandal. They're a little bit aligned, but let me quickly go through them in the behavioral science to look for in each of them. One, the notion of how people come to believe things. There's in behavioral science two principles closely aligned. One is called the mere exposure effect, and the other is called the illusory truth effect. And here's what it comes down to. The more I repeat something, the more people will think it's likely to be true. Now, that sounds stupid because I might be repeating a nonsense, but actually, unfortunately, this 40,000-year-old brain was programmed that novelty, something brand new, is a threat. It might kill you, something brand new. A new person, a new animal, a new color might mean it's a poisonous berry. Something very familiar, because it's familiar, didn't kill you before, so it's probably okay. So by repetition, they have found that humans can be eroded in their throwing up of barriers to belief if you repeat something over and over and over again. So the idea of Twitter bots is not that you're so stupid that they craft a message that suddenly you go, oh my God, I've changed my views.
It's repetition.
It's high frequency, high volume repetition. Mm. And when you hear something 10,000 times, seemingly from different sources, even in the background, even below conscious level, somewhere in your brain it's saying, yeah, I've heard that before. I've heard that a lot.
Well, it's the stem of bias and prejudice, is it not?
Yeah. This notion of an implicit bias, things just lurking there over and over and over again. So that's the Twitter bots. Mm. Now, if you look at the Cambridge Analytica and Facebook, this is something that is actually deeply scientific, can be used for good or for malicious purposes. There is a deep personality science. I wrote not long ago in Harvard Business Review a piece on this, on what marketers need to know about personality trait science. And basically, it's a five-letter acronym. These are the five factors that really make up every human's personality. The five make an acronym, a word called OCEAN, like the sea, OCEAN. O stands for openness to experience, and they're all either low or high on a spectrum. So openness to experience, when you're very low in openness, you go back to the same restaurant, same resort, you kind of buy the same clothes, you might vertically invest in music, you get the same artist's latest album, but you don't explore out, right? Mm-hmm. The extremely high, you go bungee jumping, you try a new resort, you try new music all the time, okay. Right? The next one, C, conscientiousness. When you're high on conscientiousness, you're Hermione Granger. Mm-hmm. When you're low, you're George Costanza.
Got it. Nice comparison.
When you're thinking about the next one, the E is extroversion. We all know what that is. A, agreeableness. When you're sort of high on agreeableness, you're warm and you're trusting and accepting. When you're low on agreeableness, you're skeptical, cynical, a bit acerbic. And the last one, N, is neuroticism. If you're high on neuroticism, you're Woody Allen. And if you're low, you're Oprah. Right. And so you can see that when you think of these five together, it's kind of like a sliders on an audio board and you're mixing the music. Well, you're mixing your personality. But the thing is, it gets kind of locked in about the age of 25 or 30.
So the Cambridge Analytica looks at that. They apply this OCEAN framework. And then based on that, then they start deploying messaging according to how you will receive it based on that profile.
Right. So if I know your personality, and there are two different ways I can find that out. One, traditionally, the scientists have done it for 40 years. For 25 years, they've agreed on the methodology. And it's very useful for things like fighting smoking addiction, drug addiction, obesity. Because if I know your personality, I know which messaging and which behavioral targeting might work best for you. It's a kind of matching. It's like personalized medicine in a way. Mm. So the science actually really is true and works. It's not like Myers-Briggs, which is less scientific, and it's certainly not like a zodiac sign. There's a real science of personality trait. So if I could match my messaging to trigger certain anxieties or fears in you by knowing your personality, it might work better than just taking a guess at what might move you, what your hot buttons might be. Now, how I find it out? Well, one is I give you a quiz. So one of the things they did was a kind of fun personality quiz. But here's the other thing I can do, and this is where the scandal erupted, was I give you a quiz, Steve Stein, but now I have access to all of your friends on Facebook. And what if they don't take the quiz? What if I could infer their personality from their Facebook likes? Mm. Because just as when you shop on Amazon, and if you do enough shopping, Amazon gets to know you really well. They can predict what books you'll like. They can predict what products you'll like. Well, the same thing's true with Facebook likes. Mm-hmm. And that science was done by my co-author in the Harvard Business Review story. And so when you look at that, you look at the likes as a kind of footprint for this personality. And you infer the personality. And now you target them based on the inferred personality from their Facebook likes. Now, it's not voodoo. It actually has some merit in science, but can be used maliciously. And here's the difference. Part of our article, we said the science is real, but how would you use it ethically? Number one, the person whose personality you're assessing needs to know you're assessing their personality. It shouldn't be done in secret. Yeah. Number two, you should not come back and target that personality, that person. It should be done, if anything, in big aggregate. So I find lots of people with a similar personality for the similar messaging. Three, the intent. Is my intent aligned with your best wishes? Mm. If my intent is aligned with you getting healthier or happier or richer, that's one thing. If my intent is to scare the bejesus out of you to voting, that's not a good intent.
This is Inside Asia, and I'm Steve Stein. You're listening to my conversation with Chris Graves, president and founder of the Ogilvy Center for Behavioral Science in Washington, D.C. We're taking liberties this episode to reach beyond our traditional stomping ground in Asia. We're talking about the essential nature of communications and its central role in maintaining peaceful human coexistence. Whether subjugated to the verbal salvos of a certain U.S. president or manipulated by global social media corporations, toying with the truth can have serious social and political consequences. To explore this further, let's get back to my conversation with Chris Graves, president and founder of the Ogilvy Center for Behavioral Science. We've been talking about how new developments in behavioral science have resulted in enormously effective ways of exploiting the biases and fears of a population for a specific purpose. Given that such science exists, I asked him, how do we guard against it?
Until this was discovered, nobody even knew there was such a thing. They didn't know that there was such a thing as personality science, nor did they know you could target by inferred personality, because you couldn't really go to Facebook and say, I want to buy somebody who's very low on openness, high on conscientiousness, and low on neuroticism, for example. You couldn't do that. But you could go in and say, I want to buy people who have this country music, this book, this cuisine, this sense of humor, because it correlated to certain personalities. So one is, now that we all know that, you need to take responsibility for what you put out there in the clear.
You as in every individual who uses Facebook or other social networks.
You as an individual need to know that data is very valuable. And even things you think are innocuous are no longer innocuous when you see other clusters. Imagine this. Imagine I had never told you about constellations. And every night you looked up into the sky and you just saw all these points. You think they're beautiful, but so what? And then I show you how to see Orion. You can never unsee Orion again. Mm-hmm. And so what this is doing is saying to people that we're really constellations by your personality clusters, by how you behave, and that data can be very valuable. Now, you should arm yourself with privacy, but you should also know these bits of science about how they might be used for good. For example, Ulysses did this. If you remember the story, he did not want to be killed when he sailed past the sirens. And so what would happen usually with sailors is the sirens would sing and they would lure the ships into the shipwreck, into the rocks. They would become shipwrecked and the Gorgons would eat them, right?
Yeah.
So instead, what he wanted to do was he wanted to go through there to experience the siren song, but not perish because of it. So he put beeswax in all the ears of his sailors so they couldn't hear it. And he had them lash him to the mast so he couldn't get out, no matter what the torture. So that worked. So what we need to do is the equivalent.
Lash ourselves to our seats and just, you know, keep listening, but not do anything with, not act on it.
Well, lash yourself to that digital mast, baby, because if you want to go out and play, somebody's going to get hurt.
Right.
So I think there is regulation that could be done. I mean, there could be an approach to looking at what is proper and improper targeting of individuals. Mm. I know that that sounds like a slippery slope, but look, if you don't, it's just an opportunistic approach to targeting what is deep, dark, and irrational in all of us.
Chris, I mean, the problem I see with this is that almost like what you were talking about earlier, at some point, the more you tell people something they don't want to hear, they're going to reject it. And if they reject it, they're going to continue to be subject to it and victim to it. And you do get this sense that, and anecdotally and probably statistically, that a lot of people already feel the game is up. Their privacy is exposed. They'll never get it back. So you might as well play along.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people just think, what's the big deal?
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
But there is a big deal. That's your point.
Well, there could be a big deal.
Well, I mean, there's evidence to suggest we have to safeguard against, you know, Russian hackers and influencing, you know, national elections. There's evidence.
Well, and when you look at that, what's the response you get for somebody who feels that they are cast as a dupe when you say that? They said, I didn't see any Russian in the voting booth with me.
Right.
Because they don't understand the behavioral science of mere exposure and illusory truth effect, the high volume, high repetition. Now, I don't think actually that the Twitter bots would change a diehard Bernie or Hillary voter into a Trump voter. What they can do is mobilize somebody who might not have voted or might have been a little bit lazy about voting and really agitate them so to make sure they do vote. Mm. And on the other hand, somebody who was really a hesitant voter suppress that vote.
Yeah, I just say, listen, you don't have to worry about it because it's actually a done deal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I mean, with this in mind, I mean, so you're saying that universal education of what you're up against when you do dabble on social media networks is one thing. The second thing is every company is now coming out with their new release of their privacy laws and their privacy requirements. And they say, read this, all the small type, and just check the box and on you go. But that's exactly what people, I'm deleting hundreds of them, dozens of them, right? Because, and I know everybody else's too, because again, you choose to either play or you not play, but you're not probably going to take the time and energy to learn at this micro level what it entails, and therefore will probably be subject to these problems going forward.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at, first of all, what I did is one of the things you can do in behavioral science, it's really cool, is if you have an executive or a leading figure and they're curious about how they are perceived based on their speeches, their public speaking and their language, I actually run a battery of tests against that, where you can find some fairly straightforward things like what level of education does it take to understand you? Another one is a concreteness test, which is really important. Concreteness means when I speak, how easy is it for you to picture what I'm talking about? That's concreteness. If the opposite is abstraction. Now, it turns out that concreteness correlates with credibility. So if I say, for example, if I give you a very abstract answer to immigration reform versus say, I will build a wall. The wall, you don't get much more concrete than a wall. So that can actually correlate with credibility when you speak in a concrete fashion. Now, when you think about this
term— Are you suggesting that that speaks to Trump's success as a politician because he is just so completely dead blunt and actually relatively inarticulate to the point of it's such a simple message that people grasp it, hold it, and don't release it?
I think that's absolutely so. And there's correlation between the ability for very simple language that creates pictures in people's heads that correlate to credibility and a belief in action from this
Give person. The FEMA example, if you wouldn't mind, quickly, because it's a great one.
So FEMA does amazing work, actually, and I've had the pleasure of working closely with some of their people.
But tell our listeners who that is.
FEMA is the Federal Emergency Management Agency in the United States. They're the ones who, you know, famously or infamously go in after a natural disaster, and they're often the whipping boy for if something goes wrong or takes too long or they don't have enough supplies or what have you. But it is a very decentralized, by design, very decentralized agency so that it can be resilient, so that there are different regions that can take care of the problems locally everywhere. Well, cleaning up after disaster and helping people after disaster is part of what they do. But a big part of what they do is try to communicate risk, which is very tough for human beings to do accurately.
To grasp what that means.
Yeah. To the probability of something bad happening to you. And you have many reasons why you don't want to believe that. One is called an optimism bias. And the moment you, have you ever bought a lottery ticket, Steve?
I have. Okay. And I lost.
Yes. But the moment you buy that ticket, that's the best moment of all, right?
Yeah, I was already counting it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Every human does. That's why it works. When if you looked at the odds, you would never, ever buy a lottery ticket. So that optimism bias works for humans. It also keeps them blind to threats. So if I were to show you the statistical odds of you dying as a heavy smoker at a young age, you'd say, yeah, but not me. Or dying of hypertension because you're hugely obese, and you'd say, yeah, but not me. And so this optimism bias also works with threats of natural disaster. If you live in a high-risk flood zone, you go, yeah, but not me.
Yeah, or my house.
It's the old Garrison Keillor, which was the radio show in America, Prairie Home Companion, where he said that, you know, basically all the children are above average. So we all, and humans, particularly Americans, when they're tested, all think 90% of people think they're above. I want to meet the 10% who don't, but the 90% of people say they're above average, which is, of course, mathematically impossible.
Yeah, or in the case of Trump, you're genius.
A stable genius.
Yes, no doubt. But then to the FEMA example, when they went into these flood zones and said to the homeowners.
Yeah, when they say, listen, you're in a high risk zone. Now, here's the problem. A number of things as a homeowner is rushing to mind. One is, this is going to hurt my property values. And do I have to buy insurance now? And the answer is probably it will hurt your property values. And yes, you do have to buy insurance now. It's mandatory if you're in a high-risk flood zone. And so then you get into the problem of, well, why have you changed the map so that I'm in the high-risk flood zone because I didn't used to be? And now you got to talk about climate change, which is so politicized, you can't really talk about climate change.
So people go a little bit dull in the eyes and they just can't hear it.
Or they get very angry with you.
Right.
And they say, you know, you're wrong. I don't have a problem with flooding here. So then when you're trying to convince people about probability, there's something with humans called the ratio bias, sometimes called the numerator bias. And it's really wild. And it goes like this. Just picture this. If I were to give you a quiz, and the quiz is, listen, listener, which of these three things is most likely to occur? 1 out of 10? 10 out of 100? Or 100 out of 1,000. And you'd say, you're a moron. They're all three the same. They're the same fraction, but not to humans. Remember that 40,000-year-old brain, many, many people would say, no, 100 out of 1,000. Yeah. It's called the numerator bias because the bigger number on the top of the fraction, without doing the math, people think it's more likely to happen. So FEMA, unfortunately, goes out and says, well, and this is what they had to do. They had to say you're in a 1% zone. And they go, what does that mean? And well, every year there's a 1% chance of a devastating flood here. And people say, well, Jesus, that means 99% chance. Nothing's going to happen. I'll take those odds. Or they say you're in a 100-year flood zone. They say, what does that mean? Well, once on average, every 100 years, there'll be a devastating flood where you live. And then the guy says, I've only lived here 6 years. I got 94 to go. And so it's a really tough problem they face of communicating risk and changing behavior, because part of what they can get cities, towns, and people to do is to mitigate. They can get them to build higher. They can build them to put in better drainage, all kinds of things that would lead to less damage when eventually that flood will come, and it will come. So there's a behavioral science of changing behavior related to risk.
And with that science then comes altering the message in a way that people can visualize, understand, and embrace it.
Yeah. Absolutely, because you try to find practical applications. And so for homeowners, for example, they can picture their home. They can't picture climate change. And if they've never lived through a devastating flood, they kind of can't picture that very well either. So there have been a number of tests where people who have been through a similar natural disaster are more likely to take action, particularly if it wasn't too long ago. They might just chalk it up and say, well, it just happened 2 years ago. It's not going to happen again. Mm. And of course, then they go, how on earth did that happen? We had two 100-year storms back to back. Mm. Well, it's kind of like rolling, you know, a six on a die and rolling a six again. It does happen.
Yeah.
But on average, it's going to be one out of six.
Right.
So what you need to do is make it very clear and concrete in their heads. Just like I will build a wall, you get people to picture their home.
Underwater.
Picture their home underwater, devastated, the damage that we've done. Just, we've even created a virtual reality program that takes people through that. Yeah, here
what it would look like.
What it would look like. Mm-hmm. So that makes it more concrete in their minds, which actually they begin to feel differently about that a little bit. And then we reframe the math. If I were to say the same math to you, one out of 100, if I instead were to say, you have a 30-year mortgage on your house. During the life of that 30-year mortgage, you have a 26 out of 100 chance of having a devastating flood. Now, that sounds much worse or much more likely to happen, but the math is the same.
The same.
So a lot of communicating risk is seemingly irrational. And it's because of that 40,000-year-old brain we're operating on. It was really smart and really well adapted for when our day job and our night job was to find something, beat it to death, eat it, or run away, and then have sex.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. You've been listening to my conversation with Chris Graves, president and founder of the Ogilvy Center for Behavioral Science. And now it's time for our Asia Insider Minute, that part of the show where I outline a few key takeaways from the episode of the conversation I've just had. First, let's make it clear that we're not talking here about old school market effectiveness. We all remember those days when advertising was the equivalent of throwing spaghetti at a wall. Some of it stuck and some of it didn't. This is a different story and a different world, and it comes out of the stark realization that traditional demographic research failed to predict both the Trump election and the Brexit vote. It's hard to believe, and what feels like a departure from rational thought can in fact be scientifically explained. Up till now, facts form the basis for making key predictions. But what happens when the facts are altered, manipulated, or maligned? The new reality suggests that it's no longer about the facts. Your expert is my idiot, your facts are my fiction. Enter Chris Graves and the diagnostic tools he and his team at Ogilvy have created to map cognitive bias and to tap into those hidden forces that determine, often irrationally, the choices we make. What Chris is telling us is that we, human beings, are hardwired to make bad decisions. We actively seek out information that confirms what we want to think in the first place. And when you consider that 90% of us believe we're above average, it's hard to dispel the firm positions we've taken. That's the inbound process. Now the out. Every day and in hundreds of ways, we work our digital platforms, spitting out information, opinions, and conjecture that make those biases plain to those who have the means and the will to exploit it. I'm a Springsteen fan. I subscribe to the New York Times. I prefer green chili to red chili. I have a thing for mythology. Big nature is a big interest of mine. Can you change the way I vote based on these stated and insinuated preferences? Probably not, but design an algorithm that taps into some subliminal bias of mine and my desire to vote and vote at all costs goes through the roof. Without even knowing, I may have served the purpose of a greater power or an institution with a dark agenda. This is the world we live in. This is behavioral science in the age of Trump. It is new, very strong magic. And when it comes to such magic, there are only two real choices. Either we figure out how it works or risk falling under its spell. What do you think? Visit us at www.insideasiapodcast.com or visit me on the Inside Asia Facebook or LinkedIn page. We want to know what you think. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia. And thank you for listening.